Real Life, the program that talks about the life of real estate in the Hamptons and the North Fork. The people, the places, and the things that are the pulse and heartbeat of life on the East End. And now, Associate Broker of Sotheby's International Realty, your host, John Christopher.
Welcome back to Real Life, and this is your host, John Christopher. And today I have as my guest, Frank Melia of Quantic Bank. Hi, Frank. How are you today?
I'm doing great, John. How are you?
Good. Wonderful, actually. You've been on the program before, and one of the things I want to talk about is the updating of reverse mortgages. There's some recent articles regarding reverse mortgages that have mentioned some changes that were made to the program. Can you elaborate about those changes?
Absolutely, John. The reverse mortgage program has made some big changes over the past 5 years, but most recently, the two changes that I'd like to discuss with you today have affected homeowners in a good way, in my opinion. The first thing that HUD and FHA has proposed is financial assessment. What I mean by that is, prior to implementing the financial assessment rule, most homeowners did not have to show any income, and they really didn't have to have any established credit or have a good credit rating, more or less. So that did allow most people, it's an age-based program, obviously, so if you were 62 years of age.
Or older, right?
Or older.
Right.
Or at least one of the owners has to be at least 62, that the people would qualify for a reverse mortgage.
Can I step in for a second and ask you a question? And something I've always wondered about, how does it work? Okay, you have a husband and wife that are on the title to the property. The husband turns 62, but the wife is, say, 58. How do you get a reverse mortgage? Is it only half of the property because it's is that how that works?
That's a great question, John. What happened was there was new legislation that came out. A few years back, there was a lawsuit against HUD pertaining to borrowing spouses. What I mean by that is a typical situation that we found around the country was there would be one spouse over 62, let's say 65, and there'd be one spouse below 62, let's say 55. And there's more common, you know, you see that more common today. So prior to the new legislation that was passed, you would have to take the person that was under 62 off of title. And I personally never felt comfortable with that, and the industry didn't feel comfortable with that, simply being because when the reverse mortgage became due, when the older spouse passed away, the younger spouse would not be on title. So they wouldn't really even have an opportunity to stay in the residence.
So they'd have to move at that point.
They'd have to basically sell the property at that point. But then what happened was AARP got involved a few years ago because what was going on was some of the older individuals obviously were passing away. The younger spouse was being displaced. So what they do today, to answer your question, is as long as one of the spouses is 62 years or older, they'll use a blended age, meaning they'll take the 58-year-old, they'll take the 65-year-old, but they'll use the 58-year-old's life expectancy. So what it will do is it will affect the amount that they can borrow because HUD uses age 100. So if you were using a 62-year-old, they would just use age 100, and they would use, you know, that the loan could possibly be out there for 38 years. So when someone, specifically a spouse, is under 62, we just now have to use the younger age. So it's going to bring down the amount that they can receive, but they still are entitled to be on the loan. So what it does now is it allows the 58-year-olds and the 62 or older to be on the loan. So if one of the spouses passes away, the loan is still with the other borrower. Right. It doesn't end at that point and displace the younger borrower.
So the younger wife, we'll say it's a wife that normally women live longer anyway, she doesn't have to be looking for another home or selling the house? Or
absolutely. The loan would stay in her name and as long as she lives in the property.
Now, will she get once the husband, we'll say he passes away, will she then get the, because of reverse mortgages, is that the bank is paying every month a certain amount of money, correct?
Well, that's one of the options. They can either take a lump sum up front.
Oh.
They can take a line of credit where you could just draw from it. Give us a call on our 800 number and draw from it, and it'll go directly into your checking account, or take a monthly check. Now, I think what you're going to ask is if, you know, if the older spouse passes, does the younger spouse, it does not affect the surviving spouse. If they were on an income stream, that would continue with a monthly check.
So it doesn't change because all of a sudden the age, she can live to 100.
Absolutely. The amount that the homeowners receive through a reverse mortgage are set at the time of closing. So we would take both people's age in determining how much they would get, and that would continue for both their life expectancies.
Right. Now, I've heard that you can purchase a home with a reverse mortgage. How does that work?
It works the same as a reverse mortgage would if you were just looking to take money out of your property, meaning you still qualify based on age. But you do have to show some income and you do have to show some credit. That was the financial assessment that we were discussing earlier. And all you have to do is show that you've paid your creditors in a timely fashion and show that you do receive enough income to at least cover your real estate taxes and your homeowner's insurance.
Now, would that be, when you say income, would pensions be considered income?
Absolutely. A typical income that is shown to us by a couple purchasing a house here on the East End would be maybe pension and Social Security income. Now, remember, your income has to be enough to cover your annual real estate taxes and your insurance. So it's a little less stringent than on a typical loan.
Mm-hmm.
There's no ratios that are calculated. And this is HUD and FHA's way of just ensuring that you can pay your obligations. And the only obligations we have to look at regarding a reverse mortgage is real estate taxes and homeowners insurance. We don't have to look at other obligations, but we will look at the credit score just to make sure that you've shown a history of making your payments on time.
How can someone get in contact with you to talk about this further?
The best way to reach me is to call me directly. You can reach me at 888-954-7463. Once again, that's 888-954-7463.
Great. And is there a website that they can go to?
Absolutely. You can go to Quantic Bank. That's Q-U-O-N-T as in Tom, I-C, bank.com. And then just click on Lending Professionals and then click on Frank Melia, and you can reach me directly online.
Frank, it's been a delight having you on the program. This is John Christopher, and we'll be right back with my next guest after the short break, Lydianne Intertornado, who is the interior designer for Stellar Designs.
Support for 88.3 comes from Sotheby's International Realty, local experts worldwide. With over 100 international offices, Sotheby's has 4 Hamptons locations in Southampton, Bridgehampton, East Hampton, and Sag Harbor. Learn more at john.christopher@sotheby'shomes.com.
Hi, this is John Christopher for Real Life, and today I have as my guest Lydianne Intertornado, who is the interior designer for Stellar Designs. Lydianne, how are you today?
I'm doing great, John. Pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, it's wonderful having you here. I mean, you light up the studio, actually. You know?
Oh, thank you.
Good.
I'm sparkling.
Yeah, we don't need
lights. No, you love
here.
My magnetizing energy, huh, John?
Right. Exactly. Exactly. So how did you find your calling as an interior designer?
Well, as a child, I always had a penchant for creative outlets. I was very much into drawing and painting as a child, and I was just always very creative, and I always need that creative outlet in life. But I would spend endless hours as a child, John, configuring my, like, school blocks, my play blocks into, like, a dollhouse, like an imaginary dollhouse, and I would align the blocks in certain places so it would be, like, imaginary furniture, and I guess I just... You know, it was a calling early on, and, you know, it was something I would always kind of gravitated to as a hobby, and then I facilitated it into a business.
That's phenomenal. Now, your background, you had graduated in psychology and also got your master's.
Yes.
And so how did that come about that you went into that? Did you go after school? Did you go into something else and then go into interior? I mean, what happened? How did you get to where we are today?
Well, you know, it's very interesting because life can be very precarious sometimes. And, you know, you don't always know how, you know, the turns and the courses life is going to take
you
on.
That's what I like.
Yeah, it's just interesting. I definitely love my educational background. I'm so happy I did that because I utilize it every day just in my interpersonal relationships, in marketing my company, in, you know, forming that rapport with my clientele. So it's definitely been beneficial. I think when you have a background in psychology, you utilize it every day in everyday life.
Now, can you read people, like, in other words, your clients? A lot of times, do they say, okay, I really want this kind of design, but you know that they should have something else just based upon your background in psychology?
Well, definitely. It's when you meet and you sit with a client, you really have to kind of ascertain what they want to achieve in the space. You have to gauge their personality type so you know how to communicate effectively with them and to, you know, implement the design plan and have everything go smoothly. So every personality is different. I get some micromanagers, you know, that try to like micromanage every aspect of it. And then I have other clients that really delegate all the design responsibility onto you. Those definitely are more pleasurable because they don't infringe upon your creative, you know, your creative vision. But, you know, definitely you need to have great interpersonal relationship skills just in business in general.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. Now, I was just thinking now, do you find that mostly your clients are, or where the power base is coming from, is from the women as compared to the husbands?
It varies. I do a lot of commercial spaces, John.
Oh.
So primarily I deal with, I would say, more a male clientele. But, you know, if I do residential, then you tend to, you know, be more hands-on with the woman. And they vary because residential is definitely a more intimate setting. So
how's that different from commercial? I mean, you say you do commercial interior design.
Yes.
Is it catering to the business? In other words, the image that the business is trying to portray?
Oh. Well, there's a lot more things that go into the commercial design. When I'm doing commercial interiors, I really want to conceptualize what the business is, what they're trying to achieve, what they're trying to promote, how they're trying to market their company. I think you have to infuse the logo. You want to infuse that into your design. You know, you have to create a brand. You have to increase work productivity. So you would probably want to, you know, work with colors that would definitely allow, you know, optimal work productivity from your clientele. So there's a lot more things that go into hand.
Are certain colors more productive than others?
Yes.
Really?
Yeah. They definitely do. Like, I wouldn't do red in a commercial space unless it was a certain type of maybe like a food. Like, red's known to increase appetite, and it's more of an excitatory color. But, you know, you want as much, even in residential spaces, you want as much natural lighting as possible into a space. I think that's optimal just for everyone. The lighter the color, the more airy it feels. People tend to stay awake longer. Calming colors like blues and greens are more calming. So there's many things that go into the space. But when I do a commercial space, really the essential thing is having the design of the commercial space be reflective of the business and be reflective of the brand and the logo, and everything needs to kind of intertwine.
Wow. That's fascinating what you're saying there. Now, do you have a philosophy when it comes to interior design?
Yeah, I do, actually. I always say to my clients, I'm like, conceptualize what you want to achieve from the space, right? It's supposed to be your home. It's supposed to be your sanctuary. It's a place you retreat to at the end of the day. Or if it's your commercial space, you're working there. What do you want to achieve? How do you want to utilize it? How are we going to optimize functionality? These are all things that you need to take into consideration.
You know, it's interesting. I remember having an architect on, and he said similar to what you're saying, that a home is a womb with a view.
Yes.
And it sounds like that's the same philosophy that you're incorporating into your interior design.
Yeah, well, you want to infuse the person's intimate feelings into the space, especially in a residential setting. It should feel intimate. It should be indicative of who that family is, who that client is. It should be representative of them, their interests, their hobbies, and family unification. That's really what design
is. So do you meet
the
whole family? Do you even meet the kids?
It depends on the client if they want to bring them, but usually not. If they're younger clients, You know, I do occasionally, if it's like decorating a children's room, I always like to speak with the parent or the child. I did one son's room, and he had a penchant for dinosaurs. So we infused dinosaurs in the space, but not where it looked very artificial and babyish.
So as he grew,
because you know, it was just subtle, minimal accents that were very tasteful, because I will only incorporate things into my designs that I would personally, you know, like. I wouldn't push a design onto someone if I didn't think it was definitely suitable. So in that space in particular, we infused subtle elements that could be removable.
Right. So what, if you had a single piece of advice that you could offer mm-hmm. a prospective client, what would that be when it comes to interior design?
It would definitely be maximize as much natural lighting as possible. I think that's just, I think it's so important for your overall emotional well-being. And I think people need to take that into consideration. The colors that you use, I love monochromatic colors. And then you can put pops of color in your accent, because then you have variation. You won't get bored. And, you know, if the styles change, then at least you have a monochromatic base, and then you can work off of that.
Oh, interesting. Now, you have clients in Manhattan, and you have clients out here in the Hamptons.
Yeah.
So is it different working with a Manhattan client as compared to working with the client that's out here?
There's usually a lot of crossover with my Manhattan clients.
Because they have a beach house out here.
They have a beach house out here.
But they don't want to decorate it like they're...
No, they want it completely different. And you definitely want it completely different, because every time, if you're in a position where you have the luxury of having multiple homes, you want each place to evoke a different mood. So in the city, you know, it's a metropolitan area. You get a very modern kind of look that people want to infuse in their space. You have the skyline of Manhattan, so that usually takes on a more modern feel, and people want to implement that into the space. And out here, people like more of a transitional design or infusing a beach interior.
And very good. Yeah. If someone wanted to consult with you, Lydia, how could they do that?
Well, the best way to reach me would be just visit my website, and you can click on one of the links, and you can send
what
me a direct
Stellar,
email.
Stellar Designs? I mean, Google that? Or
no, it's Stellar Interiors by LydiaAnn.com. So you can reach me on there or on social media. I'm all over it. You know, I'm always about promoting my business, and I think you have to, but definitely go link onto my website. You can send me an email, reach out to me, and I would love to help you beautify your space.
Fantastic. Lydia, it's been a delight having you on the program. This is John Christopher, and we'll be right back with my next guest, author and leisure domain extraordinaire, Alan Kronczyk. Hi, this is John Christopher, and welcome back to Real Life. And today I have with me author, conjurer, and legerdemain extraordinaire, Alan Kronczyk. Alan, how are you today?
I'm very well today.
Yes,
yeah,
you look great. And that's
I'm happy to be here, yeah.
Yes, I know. I'm very happy to be here also, you know, as compared to being maybe in the ether or someplace like that, you know. It's funny, I was thinking about, we're going to talk about magic. And one of the people that you admire, and I always admire, was Houdini. And he was a guy that he told his wife, if anybody would come back from the other side, it would be he. Or it would be him, I should say, grammatically speaking. And he never came back, did he?
Not yet. Yeah, I think we have 7 more years to the 100th anniversary of his passing, and surely there will be many more trials.
Oh, right.
You know, there were seances after his death pretty much every year.
Is that right?
And they had a secret word between them, Harry and Bess. And so the medium had to know what that word was to prove contact.
And they could never find that out.
Well, at one point, a hustler convinced Bess into telling him the word, but she later admitted that she had told him.
Wow. So that is fascinating. So, but maybe he arranged that, you know, that Houdini somehow or another conveyed this to this hustler for Bess to to know.
Well, it was her wife who conveyed it to the Houdini's wife, who told the hustler what the word was.
Right.
Yeah, and then he held a seance and he said, "Oh, the word is coming through. Is this the word?" She said, "Yes, that's the word." He said, I've done it. You know, Houdini's talking to me.
Wow.
But. Yeah.
So once you go over to the other side, you're over on the other side. Okay. Anyway, so when were you bitten by the magic bug?
Oh, early on, 9 or 10 years old. I got a Misto magic set from my parents.
Uh-huh.
I saw a magician at a Cub Scout Blue and Gold, and I just was compelled to find out what this was.
Wow. That's fascinating. Now, you're considered a close-up magician, but there are other types of magicians. Can you give us like an overview of what the other...
Sure. I mean, some of it is just based on size and visibility. So, you know, the largest types of magicians are generally known as illusionists. And these are guys who work with large pieces of apparatus, you know, guillotine spikes, many kinds of boxes, lots of assistants twirling stuff around and jumping around on stage. So that's the stage illusionist. There's a size of magic called parlor magic, which is suitable for a living room or a small theater, 100 people, you know, intimate magic where in the back row, somebody can still discern a playing card from that distance.
Right.
And no animals and no dancing girls and usually a one-person show. And then there's just intimate around the table close-up magic, one-on-one or one-on-three or four. Also done strolling at parties where magicians, you know, mingle with the guests and work for three or four at a time.
Right. Ricky Jay was like that, wasn't he?
Well, Ricky Jay was very particular as to where he performed. He was a brilliant parlor magician, also a close-up magician.
Right.
But when he did a show, it was for 250, 300 people at the most. And so that's the venue in which he liked to perform. He didn't perform much for other magicians except his friends. He didn't go to magic conventions. He didn't mingle with other magicians except for the three or four people he greatly admired. And then he was a historian of magic. We learned a lot of stuff from him. Brilliant guy.
Yeah.
And in a lot of movies, as you know.
Right, exactly. Now, I had the pleasure to meet him, actually. That's what I was asking, because I had worked with, as you know, Doug Henning. And he used to hang out with Doug. So when I was there, he was doing tricks, you know, and I was fascinated. I mean,
sure, no, he was brilliant. And both he and Henning at the time were like hippie types.
Oh, right.
And, you know, Ricky used to have real long hair and, you know, just a hippie kind of guy.
Right.
I'm trying to remember the name of the club, but, you know, on 8th Street, St. Mark's Place, you know, for rock and roll people. But then he became a scholar. You know, he changed that whole persona, no more hippie.
Right.
You know, just a brilliant guy.
Fascinating. Now, you wrote a book. Let's talk about you as being an author. You've written a number of books. The latest one I found interesting was Grandpa?
Grandpa Magic.
Oh, you even...
no, I brought a copy with me, sure. It's called Grandpa Magic, and it features cartoon me. And the premise of the book is how to connect with your grandkids by doing impossible, amazing stuff.
How about your own kids? I mean, so,
sure,
you know,
sure.
A lot of people are always saying, I can't communicate with my teenager.
Yeah. Well, it'll be a little tougher communicate with your teenager, although there's stuff in here for every age. You can certainly fool a teenager with material that's in this book, but there's also stuff to amuse a toddler. You know,
right.
How to turn, you can take a napkin at the dinner table and turn it into a bunny puppet that kids go nuts over, you know. So it's those kind of things. The surprise was that many people thought the book, looking at the cover, was intended for kids. And Grandpa Magic was me as a character teaching kids. So they got it for the kids, and it works just fine for the kids. You know, the kids can get it as well, because I try to write it as simply as possible.
And so the kids get it. So they're the ones that are learning to play.
Well, it depends. I'm just saying, if an 8-year-old has the book, he can learn this stuff.
As well as a grandpa.
Sure.
Yeah. Excellent. That is great. You know, Dick Cavett was on the program, and I'm sure you're aware that he was a magician, as well as Johnny Carson. But Dick's all-time favorite magician was Slidini.
We both studied with Slidini, Dick Cavett and I.
I didn't know he studied with him because he admired him. And that's why I understand that he was your mentor, right? Slidini
Well, he was. I studied with three people. I was just very lucky to be in the right time in the right place where there were living masters in New York City. And Slidini was certainly one of them. And I watched Slidini on Cavett's show, you know, and he was amazing. And Cavett's love for him was just his admiration. He got it. He really understood what a brilliant artist Slidini was. And he had taught a lot in the 40s and 50s.
I don't mean to interrupt you, but you say something very interesting. I think that most people don't understand, use the word artist.
Yeah.
And I think the really good magicians are artists because I think the public thinks, okay, you get the book there and you take a couple cards and stuff. But it's a whole finesse that takes place.
Sure. I mean, you don't go to see a play and say, well, they're not real. Then somebody wrote those words. Right. They're just saying those words. You know, it's theater, and magic is theater.
Right.
And if you accept that, then your experience is one of amazement. That's the goal. You know, that's why you go to see a magic show, for that feeling. And you pretty much only get that from a magic show.
Well, I have to tell you, I saw you perform, and you did that illusion or trick, whatever you wanted to say, but I thought you added humor, and it was really well done with the book reading.
Oh, that, yes,
yeah,
yes.
With the woman you know behind you, and you were saying go down to the second paragraph, and then the last line will be, and you said it backwards.
Yes, yeah.
And you pulled out a book, and you were reading a book, but at the end, what happened was. Tell us what you do. I mean, it's fascinating. You don't have to tell us a joke. We can just. You know.
Sure. I mean, I'm giving it away for those who haven't seen it. It's a comedy piece, and you know, in which you claim that I memorize a book every 2 days, and I bring somebody up on stage and give her a book, and she's to open at a random page, and we stand back to back, so I can't see what page she's opening up to. And so she opens, and I ask her what page she's on, so I can see if I can remember what's on it. And she tells me the page, and then I give the shh sign to the audience and take out another copy of that identical book. And she's told me what page she's on, so I go to that page, and now I can tell her what the first line is, the last line. I can read backwards, and, you know, as you saw, she's like amazed that of my astonishing memory, you know, any page, any word, I know what it is. And then we're done and we turn around and I let her see the book. And, you know, and there's a line, it's almost as if I had my own copy. And she was great. Her reaction was
phenomenal.
Couldn't be better. Yeah, so everybody laughed. But then the punchline, of course, is that my book turns out to be completely blank.
Yeah, that was amazing. That was amazing.
And so, great. So you have two wonderful endings.
Anytime you're performing, I highly recommend that the audience definitely goes and sees you, Alan Kronczyk, that you're a master magician and delightful, entertaining, and you have a great theatrical presence.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure. I'd love to have you come back again because I can always talk about magic.
This is John Christopher for Real Life on Peconic Public Broadcasting, 88.3, right here in Southampton, New York. By the way, if you're interested in hearing this program again or previous ones, you can go to peconicpublicbroadcasting.org and subscribe to the podcast. Until next time, looking forward to seeing you soon and have a safe journey.
You have been listening to Real Life, the program that talks to the people, places, and things that are the pulse and heartbeat of real estate on the East End. Your host has been John Christopher, broker associate with Sotheby's International Realty. Your producer and engineer is Kyle Lynch. Theme music by John Christopher. Questions and comments can be emailed to john.christopher@sotheby'shomes.com. Real Life is also brought to you in part by LEAP Compliance, HR's one-stop solution for sexual harassment prevention training and policies. All employers in the New York State are now required to train all employees annually, no matter the size of the company. For more information, discriminationpreventiontraining.com or 646-216-8038.